the limelight. The U.S. strategy is based on the theory that it needs a weak China to continue its hegemony in Asia. It is to be accomplished by establishing military, economic, and diplomatic ties with countries adjacent to China's borders, frustrating China's own attempt at alliance building and economic partnerships, and the utilization of tariffs, sanctions, and lawfare. We're prepared for you an article written by Mark Valencia, an internationally recognized maritime policy analyst, political commentator, and consultant focused on Asia. The piece is titled, U.S. Reveals True Intent of Its Indo-Pacific Policy. The article has been taken from the AsiaTimes.com website. Please stay with us for more of Mark Valencia's article. On 12th of January, in a revelation reminiscent of the Pentagon Papers, the outgoing Trump administration declassified and released its 2018 national security document, detailing the U.S. strategy for the Indo-Pacific region. Both the Pentagon Papers and this latest document were released with the intention of influencing government policy. The unauthorized release of the former was intended to reverse American policy in Vietnam. Whilst the unusually early release of the Indo-Pacific strategy document appeared to be designed to constrain the policy options of the incoming Joe Biden administration. They both revealed that the U.S. government has systematically lied to the American people and to Congress regarding its policy in Asia. Ironically, both lies, some 50 years apart, were cover for the same U.S. objective, to contain China. The drafting of the recent document was probably overseen by the then National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, and in particular the National Security Council's Director for Asia at the time, Matt Pottinger. The document was prepared to meet a congressional requirement to submit a declassified China strategy to U.S. lawmakers. The strategy was supposedly designed to survive many challenges and administrations, but it is unlikely to survive even the Biden administration's probably more conciliatory, incentive-laced, multilateral approach. However, make no mistake, the ultimate objective will remain the same: maintenance of U.S. primacy in Asia by constraining and containing China. Containment in this context means obstructing China's rise. The strategy is based on the theory that the U.S. needs a weak China to continue its hegemony in Asia. It is to be accomplished by establishing military, economic, and diplomatic ties with countries adjacent to China's borders, frustrating China's own attempt at alliance building and economic partnerships, and the utilization of tariffs, sanctions, and lawfare. These are all clearly elements of the present U.S. policy, and have been for some time. But for years, American foreign policy officials and echoing pundits claimed the United States was not trying to contain China and that it wanted China to succeed and prosper. This and similar sentiments were the consistent rhetoric of Barack Obama's administration, including from Obama himself. Anyone having the temerity to suggest otherwise, including China itself, was berated by U.S. officials and empathetic pundits. One of chief promoters of this strategy, Donald Trump's hawkish Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, claimed that the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy was a vision for the region of free, fair, and reciprocal trade, open investment environments, good governance, and freedom of the seas. It included no country and supposedly was open to all who wished to prosper in a free and open future. But to the contrary, the new release documents reveals that the United States' intent was to devise and implement a defense strategy capable of denying China sustaining air and sea dominance inside the first island chain in a conflict. Defending the first island chain nations, including Taiwan, and dominating all domains outside the first island chain. In other words, the United States intends to contain China in order to maintain its hegemony in the region, including in particular in the East China and the South China Seas. This explains the more aggressive behavior there by the U.S. military during the Trump administration. The duplicity did not stop with overall U.S. intent. It also involved false statements, like Mike Pompeo's, to friends and partners. At the August 2019 ASEAN-US summit, Mike Pompeo solemnly declared, "Look, we don't ever ask any Indo-Pacific nations to choose between countries. Our engagement in this region has not been and will not be a zero-sum exercise." That has now also been revealed to be false. For example, the document claims the strategy has as a goal making the US India's preferred partner on security issue. The United States would try to achieve this goal by pushing and pulling India away from its non-aligned status, in China's eyes, if not those of the world. The document also sees Southeast Asia as an accomplice in Washington's China containment policy. It urges the United States to promote and reinforce Southeast Asia and ASEAN's central role in the region's security architecture, and encourage it to speak with one voice on key issues. That may sound benign, but it is not when it is a key component of the United States' China containment strategy. From this document, it is clear the U.S. policy towards Southeast Asia is contingent on the U.S. relationship with China. Even worse than the lies, the policy was apparently formulated based on cultural bias rather than objective logic. In May of 2019, the State Department's Director of Policy and Planning at the time, Karen Skinner, said U.S. competition with China would be especially bitter because it's the first time that we will have a great power competitor that is not Caucasian. She also said the U.S. struggle with China was uniquely a fight with a really different civilization and a different ideology. These inaccurate slips of the tongue, the U.S. opponent in the Second World War, Japan, was certainly a different civilization and a different ideology, revealed that some in the Trump administration believed the U.S. and China are engaged in a Huntington-like clash of civilizations. Indeed, Kyron Skinner claimed that Donald Trump's policies had led scholars of international relations to go back to first. Skinner said her job was to flesh out Trump's hunches and instincts and provide the intellectual architecture for the Trump doctrine. She claimed that the national security strategy developed by H.R. McMaster was passé and that we have evolved since then. In her view, China was a fundamental threat and there was no hope for cooperation, only a struggle for domination and thus survival. Such thinking only plays into the worst scenarios of China's hardliners and thus could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So now the United States has revealed its true intentions towards China and that some observers of US-China relations were right all along. Of course, it could be argued that this dichotomy between public and private positions was due to a Trump policy change from the previous administration, the Obama administration. Even if that were so, that would only underscore the conclusion that the word of the United States is worthless. It will only last until the next election, if until then. To many, this was just another episode of American duplicity, hypocrisy, and inconsistency. Its future avowed foreign policy positions will be considered in this light.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in Hull.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all, my brothers and sisters. You're listening to the Youth Station only on IRIB English Radio.
That's right, brothers and sisters. That guy's Hassan and I'm Zainab. Welcome to Youth Station. Thank you so very much for being with us. Hi, how you doing?
Hello, I'm good. What's
Alhamdulillah.
Up?
I'm good. Alhamdulillah.
Stuff is good.
Yeah, stuff is good. I'm really excited to talk about this today's topic. That's why I just jumped in, because I want to share something really cool with you.
But do our listeners know about the topic yet?
Well, maybe you should tell them about the topic.
Okay, so let's do one thing. Let them guess as we move on.
All right. So here is a topic where I haven't been able to find the proper equivalent. Mm-hmm. To this word,
haya,
in the English language,
uh-huh.
Right? Some people translate it as modesty. Some translate it as chastity.
Yeah, dignity, like different
words.
Exactly.
I feel that haya is that, but so much more.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the official translation of haya, the official.
Okay, but do you think that the meaning of haya is taken like wrongly, like,
definitely
these days,
absolutely,
like even in the West.
Yep.
You know what I think is, in the West, haya for them, it just means you know, haya is just for women, and haya means hijab or a headscarf for women.
Mm-mm-mm.
They just think that this is all about haya, but it's more than that.
It is more than that, but how do you think it's more than that?
So when you talk about, you know, the equal word for haya in English. So what I think is, you know, these are some words to help us, to help, you know, people understand, like, what does haya mean? But, you know, Arabic, it's a vast language.
Very vast.
So, you know,
yes.
Haya cannot be translated into one single word.
Mm-mm.
You know, you need some explanation for it. You know, it's just not related to the matters of mahram and na-mahram.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more than that. You know, modesty and all, when we talk about modesty, and as we know that modesty is not just for women.
Definitely.
It's for both men and women. You know, it includes the way how you talk, you know, how you act, how you dress and how you walk. It depends on everything.
Mm-hmm.
It depends upon your a'mal. So, as I said, that it cannot be translated into one word. So it needs an explanation. So there's one ayat in the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story before it. When Hadrat Musa alayhi salam, Prophet Musa, he went near to the well to fetch some water from it.
Mm.
So he saw that there was a queue of men standing over there. Then he saw that there were two girls standing beside the well. So, you know, they were standing, you know, a little bit farther away from the well. So he went and he asked, like, what happened? Why aren't you guys, you know, fetching water from the well? So they replied that, they replied to Hazrat Musa that, you know, all men are standing over there and we have women. We have haya. We cannot go and mix up into them.
Mm-hmm.
So what Hazrat Musa did is he fetched water for them.
Oh, what a gentleman.
So he fetched the water for them. Then, you know, he gave water to all the, you know, cattle they mm-hmm. had, all the, you know,
the herd,
the lambs, the herd.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after that, when those women, they went back to their home. So they were the daughters of
Nabi Shu'aib and
Hassan. So he asked them, like, you guys are early today.
Mm.
So that so-and-so happened. They said that, call that person, Hazrat Musa.
Mm.
So when she went to call Hazrat Musa, she said that, you know, my dad is calling. So, you know, over here, I wanted you guys to get, you know, over here. So over here, Quran says that, tamshi ala istihya. So that girl, you know, she used to walk in a different way.
She walked upon modesty.
So, you know, what haya means, it's not just about, you know, the matters of mahram and not mahram.
Yeah, definitely.
So haya means, you know, being mindful of the Creator.
Yes, being mindful that there is a respected observer watching your every
deed. She walked with modesty in the sense that, you know, she was mindful. She knew that there's a Creator who's watching her.
Mm.
And she was walking in that way, like keeping in her mind.
So it is a level of self-respect, haya. And I think when they say haya is something fitri, it's an innate
mm-hmm.
nature of human beings, this is what they mean, rather than, you know, the chastity of covering oneself mm-hmm. and having hijab.
Mm-hmm.
Hijab is one of the manifestations of haya, but that doesn't necessarily, the form of hijab we have as Muslims, mm-hmm. is not innate.
Yeah.
It's something that we reached through intellectual reasoning and ahadith.
Yeah.
It's not something that we're all born with. Oh, the moment I was born, I knew I had to wrap my hijab like this and put on a chador. This is not my innate.
Mm-hmm.
My innate, what they mean when they say haya is innate,
mm-hmm.
is that degree of self-respect,
mm-hmm.
the notion of being aware and self-conscious of my conduct mm-hmm. when there is a respected observer watching me.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Like sometimes it's happened to me so many times, mostly because I'm so clumsy. And then I was like, oh, did anyone see me? You know? Because if someone saw me, especially if that someone is someone I admire, like a professor or Brother Hassanain, whom I respect so much.
Thank you so much.
If it's them, I'll feel more embarrassed. So I think we need to correct our understanding of haya. Mm-hmm. Like what you said, it's not something that is just observed between men and women.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That is a manifested, that's an example of haya, but that's not all that haya is. That's not the definition.
It's completely misinterpreted.
Absolutely.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
I feel that maybe perhaps the best equivalent for haya would be dignity.
Dignity. Uh-huh.
Integrity.
Yeah.
Self-respect.
Yeah.
To feel that certain actions are beneath me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm better than this.
Mm-hmm.
I am a creature whose creator watches, observes, is careful of, maintains, and sustains every second of the day.
Okay, so when you're talking about, you know, observing, I remember one thing. There's some amazing scholar. I don't remember his name.
Mm.
But he said that, you know, in our lives, you know, if someone attaches, you know, cameras, like CCTV cameras all around us, you know, for the whole day. So, and we know that someone's watching us. You know, definitely our conduct will be different.
Absolutely.
You know, now we know that, oh, someone's watching us. So, you know, my conduct, is it appropriate what I'm doing? Is it appropriate or not? You know, like when you go to the stores that there's written like a warning, there are cameras over here. You know, it's for, you know, so that you don't do any misconduct that might later get you into a problem. So when we know that cameras are around us, you know, our act, our conduct will be different.
Definitely.
So this is what haya means. We need to be mindful.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows that, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is watching us. Everyone knows. But the important thing over here is, you know, how much we believe in that. You know that, you know, our Imam Zamana alayhi salatu wasalam, you know, he's aware of all our a'mal. But how much do we believe in that? This is the important case over here. You know, if we believe in that, so most of the problem lies over here. You know, not believing in it. You know, just, okay, accepting it. Okay, God's watching us. But we need to believe in it. You know, if you ask someone, you know, like, why aren't you know, committing sins? You're like, you know, I did haya. You know, I did haya from Allah. He's watching me. So that I cannot do it because my God is watching me.
Definitely.
So the problem lies over here. So we need to, you know, everything hasn't, like, cause and effect.
Yep.
So we need to solve it this way.
Yes, definitely. We need to change our viewpoint and understanding of haya in order to be able to implement it properly in our lives.
Okay, so what this hijab and all we're talking about, I guess we can call it as, you know,
the outer
modesty.
Exactly.
And the inner modesty.
Exactly. It's an outer external manifestation of haya.
Yeah.
But the inner reality of haya, that internal reality of haya, is beyond that.
Yeah.
And that's understanding, exactly. Yeah. Understanding haya properly becomes even more important when we try to create that sense and cultivate that sense of haya within our children.
Yeah.
So what do you think we can do in order to have mindful kids that have the quality of haya in them?
So we need to start from their childhood.
Yeah.
You know, we need to, you know,
in what sense?
Like making them aware of, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, making them aware of the religion, and, you know, telling them their boundaries.
But the thing is, children, when they're until a certain age, they don't understand abstract concepts regarding religion, and that a God that they can't see is seeing them. They don't understand the concept of heaven and hell. They don't understand the concept of angels, invisible angels writing their deeds, you know, for them to be mindful. So I feel that there has to be something practical that we need to do for our kids in order to instill the quality of haya in them.
So, like, we can warn them of, you know, the outcome of their act. You know, like, if you do...
Like, threaten them?
No, not threatening them. Like, if you do so, like, the result will be this.
I think another way, maybe, I don't know, let's think about this. Do you think another way could be, if you want our child to have self-respect, you know, enough dignity not to commit sins, first we have to respect them?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because the way we speak with our children as parents turns into that inner voice.
But how can we explain, you know, sin to them?
We don't need to. I really feel that till a certain age, you don't even need to explain the concept of sin to your children.
So, like, how can we explain that such act is, you know, good or bad?
That's something that they will learn further into, like, I'm talking about training your children before they become mukallaf, before they reach Islamic maturity, right? Yeah. At that point, you don't even have to tell them what a sin is.
Yeah.
You know, it's none of their business, right? They're too young to understand the concept of sin or thawab. So I think then what's really important is, because I can't explain to my child what a sin is, I can make my child understand who she or he is, that he is respected,
Yeah.
His opinion counts.
Mm-hmm.
He's trustworthy.
Yeah.
He's valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud of her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy that she exists.
Mm-hmm.
I love her unconditionally. I, as her parent, if I instill these feelings into her heart,
yeah.
once she's old enough to create and develop a relationship with God,
mm-hmm.
she will project that onto God. You know what I mean? Because children
yeah.
feel like their parents are their first God.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They don't see the real God.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
feel like, my mom gives me food, my mm. mom gives me clothes, my
yeah.
mom protects me, my mom hugs me when I'm hurt.
Yeah, they're the superior.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She's my God now.
Yeah.
So whatever feeling she has toward her parents as a child,
mm-hmm.
when she grows up, she'll have that subconsciously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She'll have those feelings toward Allah. If I respect my child enough,
yeah.
when she grows up, she'll respect herself enough mm-hmm. not to sin.
Okay, so thank you so much, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. And I really hope that now we all have a better understanding what haya is. And
Inshallah.
Thank you so much, Sister Zainab.
Thank you for your time.
And until the next show, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. When I need you, the light, when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and on the eve of the blessed birthday anniversary of the Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, let us hear some interesting words from this Lady of Light about the purpose of creation by God Almighty. He originated things, but not from anything that existed before them, and created them without examples to follow. Rather, he created them with his might and dispersed them according to his will. Not for a need did he create them, nor for a benefit for him did he shape them, but to establish his wisdom, bring attention to his obedience, manifest his might, lead his creatures to humbly venerate him, and to exalt his decrees.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In early January 2021, a summit took place in Saudi Arabia, dubbed as the Persian Gulf Reconciliation Summit. For the first time since the blockade began in 2017, the Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani arrived in the northwestern city of Al Ula. The meeting was supposed to have sealed the reconciliation between Qatar and the PGCC, including countries that have been boycotting and blockading it, including UAE, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia. Member countries signed what was dubbed the so-called Solidarity and Stability Agreement. The text hasn't been made public, but it aims to overcome deep rifts in the 40-year history of the PGCC. The longer-term impacts of the regional rift are likely to take considerable time to heal and cannot be merely signed away with the stroke of a pen. Looking at the bigger picture, a crisis that began with former US President Donald Trump coming into office seemingly ended just before he left the White House. After all, the outbreak of the 2017 blockade happened 2 weeks after Trump visited Riyadh on his first foreign trip as US president. The irony of all of this is that during the meeting, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was present. The Saudi monarch was not in attendance at the summit, and this is unprecedented. Thus, the king's son, Mohammed bin Salman, attended and hosted the summit instead of him, leading many to speculate that he just might be crowned soon. On June 5, 2017, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt announced a blockade on Qatar. Just a few days later, on June 13, 2017, while on a visit to Washington, Saudi Foreign Minister Adil Al-Jubeir created even more confusion over the blockade.
There is no blockade of Qatar. Qatar is free to go. The ports are open, the airports are open. What we have done is we have denied them use of our airspace, and this is our sovereign right. The limitation on the use of Saudi airspace is only limited to Qatari Airways or Qatari-owned aircraft, not anybody else.
Then on June 22, 2017, Saudi Arabia and its allies issued a threatening 13-point ultimatum to Qatar. It was the price for lifting a trade and diplomatic embargo of the country in a marked escalation of the Persian Gulf's worst diplomatic dispute in decades. The list included curbing of diplomatic ties with Iran, sever all ties to terrorist organizations, shut down Al Jazeera and its affiliate stations. Shut down news outlets that Qatar funds directly and indirectly, including Arabi 21, Rust, Al Arabi Al Jadid and Middle East Eye. Immediately terminate the Turkish military presence in Qatar and end any joint military cooperation with Turkey inside Qatar. Stop all means of funding for individuals, groups, or organizations that have been designated as terrorists by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, Bahrain, the US, and other countries. hand over terrorist figures, end interference in sovereign countries' internal affairs, stop all contacts with the political opposition in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, compensation for loss of life and other financial losses caused by Qatar's policies, consent to monthly audits of the demands for the first year, align itself with the other Persian Gulf and Arab countries militarily, politically, socially, and economically, agree to all the demands within 10 days. The 10 days ended without Qatar complying. In fact, Qatar rejected the demands. Qatar's Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani on July 1, 2017, said that everyone is aware that these demands are meant to infringe the sovereignty of the state of Qatar, shut the freedom of speech, and impose auditing and probation mechanism for Qatar. Just a few years later, on February 16, 2020, while discussing the Persian Gulf, spat at the 2020 Munich Security Conference, Qatar's foreign minister said that the blockade was clearly not Qatar's fault.
I think now it's been almost 3 years since the crisis started. We were not the perpetrator of that crisis. And we've been very open and very clear that we are open to any genuine intention to resolve this problem. And we demonstrated this, in fact, when there was an opening in November, end of last year.
Tensions begin as far back as 1986, when Qatar and Bahrain were about to go to war with one another over border disputes. In 1991, the United Nations International Court of Justice decided that Bahrain had claim over Hawar Islands and one of the reefs, while Qatar was awarded the other reef, Zubarah, and the Janaan Islands. In 1992, a border clash between Saudi Arabia and Qatar resulted in 3 deaths. In 1996, Qatar and Saudi Arabia signed a border demarcation agreement. In 2000, Saudi Arabia boycotted an organization of the Islamic Conference Summit held in Doha in protest of Qatar's trade relations with Israel. In 2002, Saudi Arabia withdrew its ambassador from Doha in reaction to controversial comments that were made on the Al Jazeera satellite channel by a Saudi dissident critical of the Saudi ruling family. In 2006, Saudi Arabia withdrew its approval for Qatari plans to build a gas pipeline to Kuwait, which would have passed through Saudi territorial waters. In 2010, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, then Emir of Qatar, pardoned an unknown number of Saudi citizens accused of taking part in a coup against him. In 2011, Saudi Arabia and Qatar backed different sides in the unrest that gripped the Arab world and tensions began to surface. In March 2014, Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Bahrain suspended ties with Qatar over its support for the Muslim Brotherhood, a group labeled a terrorist organization by both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. In November 2014, Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Bahrain agreed to return their ambassadors to Doha after 8 months of tension and frozen relations between the three countries and Qatar. After that, Qatar sent forces to join the Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen, hosted King Salman on a state visit to Doha in December 2016, and ratified GCC-wide security cooperation agreements. But the blockade against it commenced anyways in 2017. The current blockade may be over, but differences still linger, especially competition over the leadership of the PGCC. The fact that Saudi Arabia and its allies decided to end the blockade on Qatar without Doha adhering to the so-called list of 13 demands shows Riyadh is the one who's really isolated on a regional and possibly on an international level. This is especially true with the change of administration in the White House. The question now is whether Qatar would benefit from reconciliation in a greater Persian Gulf Cooperation Council role, a role that angered the Persian Gulf Arab countries that surrounded it in the first place. And even more importantly is, will the reconciliation last?
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters in faith, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to this program, today's special. At the first step, please accept our congratulations on Islamic Republic of Iran victory anniversary. Today, Tuesday, is the 19th of Jamadil Thani, 1442 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 14th of the month of Bahman, 1399 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 2nd of February, 2021 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We open the Holy Quran. We listen to Surah Az-Zumar, verses 11 to 13.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Qul ya 'ibadilladhina amanu ittaqoo rabbakum lilladhina ahsanu fi hadhihi ad-dunya hasanah wa ardullahi wasi'ah. إنما يوفى الصابرون أجرهم بغير حساب.
Say, O my servants who have believed, fear your Lord. For those who do good in this world is good, and the earth of Allah is spacious. Indeed, the patient will be given their reward without account.
قل إني أمرت أن أعبد الله مخلصا له الدين.
Say, O Muhammad, indeed, I have been commanded to worship Allah, being sincere to Him in religion.
وأمرت لأن أكون أول المسلمين.
And I have been commanded to be the first among you of the Muslims.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
It demonstrates a significant point pertaining to the formative side of education. Namely, any educator and leader is supposed to be the first believer in his own doctrine, the most assiduous individual, and exceed others in making sacrifices such that others trust his sincerity and regard him as a role model in all matters. It is thus clarified that the Prophet is the forerunner of total submission to divine will. In the month of Bahman, the month of Islamic Revolution, be with today's special. On on the victory anniversary of Islamic Republic of Iran, today's special looks at the fundamentals of Iran's Islamic Revolution. The Iranian Islamic Revolution is only a point in the start of the revolution of the great world of Islam. These words of Ayatollah Khomeini, the founding father of the Islamic Republic and the leader of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, mark the beginning of a project to inspire and enable an Islamist revival across the Muslim world. Four decades on, Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and the effects of the Islamic Revolution are still felt in the region and beyond. The events of 1979, the revolution of Iran, set major powers in the Middle East on a knee-jerk path to religious authorities, altering the entire relationship between religion and politics in the Muslim world. The ideology of the Islamic Revolution bolstered Islamist groups and set an example that government with religion was possible. Dr. Fakhr Rouhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi-nasta'in. Concerning the Islamic Revolution of Iran, it must be indicated that, as its name suggests, it has been the Islamic Revolution of Iran, particularly because its leader was the clerical personality Imam Khomeini. Now we find that, throughout the history, we know that there have been many revolutions, great revolutions, such as, for example, the French Revolution, which reached its apex in 1789, the Russian Revolution, which was, which reached its culmination in 1917, and the Chinese Revolution, that took place in 1911 and 1949. The Cuban Revolution reached the victory and triumph in 1959. The Algerian Revolution reached the victory in 1962. And finally, the Islamic Revolution of Iran reached its peak in 1357, according to Hijri calendar, equivalent to 1979 in Christian era. We find that, with these great revolutions that have taken place in the world, we find that in a great majority of them, propelling force behind them was hardly something religious or spiritual. It was only the Islamic Revolution of Iran, in which not only its leader, that is the late Imam Ayatollah Khomeini, but also the whole people followed him because of his religious and clerical personality.
IRIB English Radio in the month of Bahman presents today's special.
Imam Khomeini's political thought on today's special, Alliance Between Religion and Politics. The politics that aims at leading people towards God and achieving their happiness has been implemented by the prophets and their followers. Imam Khomeini advocates such politics and opposes certain narrow-minded people who reduce Islam into its ritual and moral precepts. In his book, The Book of Sale, while referring to the issue of Wilayatul Faqih, the guardianship of jurist consult, he writes, "If one looks at various teachings of Islam, including its social dimensions, concentrates over its rituals like prayers and Hajj pilgrims, which pertains to man's relation with God and takes into account social, economic, political and legal laws of Islam, one would conclude that Islam does not deal only with ritual and moral matters, but it is meant to establish a just government and has certain rules on tax, public finance, legal issues, jihad, and international relations as well. Listen to one story from the life of Imam Khomeini. He wasn't negligent on even a single point of akhlaq. One time, somebody working for the government came to Imam for some work. His aged father also came with him. When he returned from his meeting with the Imam, he said, "When I wanted to go to the Imam, I fell in front of my father came following me. After greeting Imam, I introduced my father. Imam said, 'This aga, this sir, is your father? Then why were you walking in front of him and why did you enter first?'" See how careful and exact the Imam was, someone who had all these enemies and supervised the politics of the East and the West, did not stay negligent of even a single point of ethics.
So you find the head of the intelligence, Sawak, General Pakrawan, he once showed up and said to the Imam that, "You know what, Shah is a Shia, and you are a mujtahid, naib, deputy of the Imam, and it doesn't make any sense for a person like you to rise up against your own fellow mu'min Shia brother. And also, politics, siyasat is najis. And a person like you, who is a holy man, it doesn't add up that you, do the siyasat and politics because it's najis. And apart from that, if you happen to establish an Islamic government because you are a Shia, it's going to cause divisions between the Islamic Ummah because Sunnis will feel upset." So Imam says in his response that if Shah is a Shia, and if the way you are saying that I am a mujtahid, obviously, and I am the deputy, according to what you said, then Shah is supposed to follow me and cannot expect me to follow him. And is siyasat and politics najis for only me, or is also najis for him? And then he said that if someone makes your house dirty, you don't leave your house. You take the trash out of your house and throw it outside. So when our Islamic government is established, we are going to eliminate the differences and those people who are causing differences in the ranks of the Muslim brothers, and we will stand for the unity in the Islamic Ummah.
Today's special on IRIB English Radio presents its episodes on Fajr Decade, that is 10-day celebration of Imam Khomeini's return to Iran in 1979. Congratulations on all Muslims and fi amanillah.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.